Good morning, everyone. My name is Victor Cha. I'm professor at Georgetown and senior advisor and the Korea chair here at CSIS. On behalf of CSIS, we are delighted to be here this morning co-hosting this conference with the Northeast Asian History Foundation. As you all know, we had a delegation, most of them arrived yesterday, and we had a very nice casual dinner last night. We have a full day of activities today, so I don't want to get us too far off schedule from the beginning. Let me just say that this is an issue. History is an issue that never dies in Asia. It's very clear. It has been the source of state-to-state controversies, in some cases conflicts, and it is really an example in international relations of how affect or emotion can affect outcomes in international relations. What's interesting is that from a U.S. policy perspective, you know, Americans have a very rationalist view of policy. So we could be following a particular policy track, and then all of a sudden historical issues will come up that start standing in the way of cooperation among allies or partners, and it's perplexing to many foreign policymakers in the United States. So this conference is a great way to begin a dialogue about these sorts of historical issues. I think it's particularly important that these sorts of dialogues take place both inside and outside of Asia. Inside of Asia, they tend to get a little bit emotional and a little bit politicized. But holding some of these discussions outside of Asia might lend to a more objective and calmer discussion about these issues. So I want to thank you all for coming. President Jung of the Northeast Asian History Foundation will start us off with some brief remarks. His bio is here in this packet, the schedule that you have here. President Jung has been president of the Northeast Asian History Foundation since 2009. Prior to this position, he was president of the graduate school at the University of Seoul and dean of the College of Humanities there. Dr. Jung received his BA in history education from Seoul National University, which is the Georgetown of Korea, and an MA in Korean history from Tokyo University and a PhD in Korean history from Seoul National University. So, President Jung, you've come a long way. Thank you very much for coming, and we look forward to your remarks.
Hello, everyone. This is Jung Jae-jung from the Northeast Asian History Foundation.
이번에 저희 재단과 워싱턴 국제 전략 연구소가 공동 주관하는 학술에 의해 참석해 주신 내외 귀빈 여러분께 환영의 인사 말씀을 드립니다.
First, thank you very much for everyone who is here. This is a co-sponsored event with CSIS, and this is a great pleasure for me to meet with all of you here this morning.
오늘 참석하신 분들 중에는 저희 재단에 대해 이미 알고 계신 분들도 있겠지만은 또 잘 모르시는 분들도 있을 것입니다. 그래서 이번 기회에 저희 재단에 대해 간략하게 소개 말씀을 올리겠습니다.
Our foundation is relatively new. Some of you may know of us already, and many others may not know who we are. So I would like to take a brief moment to introduce ourselves to you.
동북아 역사재단은 동북아시아 지역의 갈등의 원인을 제공하는 역사 인식의 편차를 좁히기 위해서 한 국민의 전적인 성원 속에서 2006년에 설립되었습니다.
Our foundation was established in year 2006. At the time, the Korean people came to realize that there is much discrepancies among the perspectives that nations and states had taken as to the historical perspectives that we had in Northeast Asia, and it became necessary for us to establish this foundation so that we could somehow reduce the gap in the different perspectives that different nations had on the histories.
나라와 민족에 따라서 역사를 기록하고 기억하는 일은 다룰 수가 있지만은 역사에서 지혜와 교훈을 얻는 일은 같을 것입니다.
I think we come to realize that many states and nations, they have their own ways of recording history and also interpreting how these histories were made. However, I think we all do the same thing when it comes to learning and taking lessons and becoming more wiser for the histories.
저희 재단은 동북아시아의 여러 나라와 민족의 역사 인식에 대해 폭넓게 이해함으로써 상호 신뢰와 우호를 증진하고 평화와 번영을 위한 공동체의 구축을 지향합니다. 이를 위해 저희 재단은 각종 연구 조사와 정책 개발, 학술 지원과 협력 사업 등을 적극적으로 추진하고 있습니다.
What we do at our foundation is that we support various researches and also policy development and support of academia and what we do we carry these things out in order so that there would be a community formed in East Asia where we would be pursuing peace and prosperity together as a common goal, and this would be achieved, we hope, by enhancing understanding amongst different nations and also by exchanging views amongst nations.
이번 학술회의는 저희 재단으로서는 큰 의미를 가지고 있습니다. 올해 2010년은 일본이 한국을 강제 병합한 지 100년이 되는 해입니다.
This year, 2010, really marks a very important year for in the history of Korea. This marks the 100th year of forced annexation of Korea by Imperial Japan. And as such, holding this symposium here today in this year is quite important to us.
아직도 한국에는 일본군 위안부 문제나 사할린 강제 노역 등의 상처로 고통받는 분들이 많이 남아 있습니다. 한국민들에게 역사 문제는 여전히 충분히 해결되지 않은 현안인 것입니다.
So history is not simply in the past. It remains a current issue for us in Korea. For example, we still have people who have suffered from comfort woman system of the Imperial Japan and also the forced labor at Sakhalin. And these people, as long as these people remember what had occurred, the issue remains current.
이웃나라 사이의 역사 갈등 문제를 슬기롭게 극복하기 위해서는 올바른 역사 인식을 창출하고 그것을 공유할 수 있는 국제적, 법률적, 교육적, 정책적 방안들이 마련되어야 합니다.
So we have conflict on history, and we have continuing confrontations that we are facing today. And in order for us to find ways to more wisely overcome these difficulties, there has to be a better way to communicate with neighboring states. And we have to look at framework in international laws, education, and policies.
오늘의 학술회의에서 역사와 아시아, 정책적 이해와 법적 관점이라는 주제를 내세운 것은 바로 이러한 것들을 실천하기 위한 일환이라고 생각합니다.
And that's why in today's symposium that we want to work on the issues of policies and legal perspectives, and that's why we have our title, History and Asia.
실제로 동북아시아의 역사 문제는 영토 문제, 해양 경제 문제 등 오늘날의 국제법적 정책적 현안과 맞물려 있습니다. 따라서 국제정치와 국제 여론의 중심지인 워싱턴 DC에서 유수한 연구기관인 국제전략연구소와 정책적 국제법적 관점에서 아시아의 역사 문제를 다루는 학술회의를 개최하는 것은 매우 큰 의미가 있다고 생각합니다.
Indeed, even today, we have many issues with our neighboring states. And We have the issues of borderline determinations. We have maritime delineations. And all these things, I would say, stems really from different perspectives in history as well as other issues. And as such, it is quite significant and meaningful that we would have this symposium in this very important think tank, CSIS, and in the heart of Washington, D.C. And I certainly hope that from today's symposium that, that there would be a certain enlightenment and additional learnings that we could share.
그래서인지 이번 학술회의의 발표와 토론 및 사회를 맡아주신 분들은 역사와 법률 그리고 정책의 측면에서 최고의 권위자일 뿐만 아니라 회안을 가지고 대안을 제시해 줄 수 있는 분들입니다. 이렇게 훌륭한 분들을 한 자리에 모신 것만으로도 저는 오늘의 학술회의가 성공할 수 있을 것이라고 생각합니다.
As I look around this room, I realize that we have many scholars who are in various different disciplines such as history, law, and policies. And by looking at the people who would be making presentations and also people who would be leading these discussions, I realize that there might be some great wisdom to be had from everybody who would be here in this room. And the very fact that we have these very scholars in this room together in itself, I believe is a success already.
저는 오늘 학술회의에서 나온 많은 논의들이 한국과 주변 여러 나라 사이에 화해와 협력의 씨앗이 되어 동북아시아의 상생과 공영의 새싹으로 움터 무성하게 자라나기를 기원합니다.
And it is my sincere hope and desire that there would be conciliation and cooperation amongst the nations in East Asia. And I hope that the discussions that we have here today would be a seed so that the seed would grow into a bigger tree towards a mutual existence and mutual cooperation.
한국에는 비가 온 뒤에 땅이 굳는다라는 속담이 있습니다. 이 말을 국제관계에 적용시킨다면 어떤 나라가 국제관계에서 힘들고 어려운 일을 겪고 난 후에는 관련 당사국과의 관계가 오히려 한 단계 더 성숙해지고 더욱 돈독해진다는 것을 의미합니다.
We have a saying in Korea that ground hardens after rain. And if we were to apply it to international relations, I think we come to realize that when nations and states are at odds, and when they are able to overcome the difficulties and conflicts, then the two countries or the two nations and the two states would become more mature in their relationship, and that their relationship will be stronger for it.
동북아시아의 여러 국가들도 지난 100년 동안 겪었던 갈등과 대립의 비극적 역사에서 언제까지나 머물러 있을 수는 없습니다. 오히려 이러한 문제들을 슬기롭게 극복하여 유럽 공동체와 같은 평화 번영의 동아시아 공동체를 마련하는 데 최선을 다해야 할 것입니다.
We have in the past 100 years a confrontation and conflict throughout Northeast Asia, but we cannot linger in history too long. We must move forward, and by bringing about the wisdom of all involved, I certainly hope that there would be a co-prosperity community that would be brought about in East Asia, such as the European community is enjoying.
오늘 학술회의는 동북아시아에서의 역사 화해에 대한 지혜를 모으는 자리라고 생각합니다. 학술회의에서 얻은 성과 위에 여기 모이신 모든 분들의 성원이 더해진다면 동북아시아는 상생과 공영의 길로 나아갈 수 있을 것입니다. 그러한 점에서 동북아시아의 미래는 여러분과 우리가 함께 만들어가는 유토피아라고 생각합니다. 저의 동북아 역사재단은 이러한 원대한 꿈을 그리면서 동북아시아의 역사 화해를 이룩하고 공동 번영을 선도하는 견인차 역할을 기꺼이 수행하겠습니다.
Through today's symposium and throughout many other symposiums to be held in the future, we hope that there would be conciliation in history and also better understanding of the different historical perspectives. And through all these, I certainly hope that there would be a mutual coexistence and a mutual prosperity that could be had. And it is my sincere desire, and it is our foundation's goal, that through this symposium and other like symposiums, that we would be able to provide better understanding of different historical perspectives and bring about narrowing the gaps of the discrepancies in the historical perspectives. And, of course, this would, I hope, lead to some type of utopia.
끝으로 오늘 국제학술회의가 성공적으로 개최될 수 있도록 수고해 주신 국제전략연구소의 존 햄리 소장님과 빅터 차 교수님 그리고 스태프 여러분께 감사 말씀을 드립니다.
And lastly, I must thank President John Hamley of CSIS and also Professor Director Victor Cha and various staff members who have worked very hard to make this event a success. Thank you.
그리고 참석자 여러분께서는 오늘의 국제학술회의가 동북아시아의 역사, 정치, 외교, 법률 등에 대해 그동안 갈고 닦은 고견을 교환하는 격조 높은 지적 향연의 장소가 되기를 기원합니다.
As we have experts from various disciplines, I hope that we would have a open and active discussions on history, politics, foreign affairs, and law. And through all the exchanges that would be had in this room, I hope this would turn into an intellectual feast.
경청해 주셔서 감사합니다.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, President Jung. So now, according to the schedule, we have to take a picture of the conference participants. So we'll take a break, get some coffee for those of you who are camera shy, and I guess we'll have them all line up here for the picture. Okay. All right. So let's do that, and then we will begin the next session. Okay, now that you've all had your caffeine, the first session is Historical Issues in Northeast Asia, Perspectives from Law and Policy. And we have four distinguished panelists and one distinguished discussant. Their bios are in your packet just behind the schedule for the conference, so you can read them there. I will just introduce them to you here very briefly. To my immediate left is Professor David Kang, who is director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California and a professor of international relations. Dr. John Perry, who is director of the Maritime Studies Program at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Professor Peck Jin-hyun, who is a judge for the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, as well as a professor of law at Seoul National University. Michael Oslin, who is senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And then the discussant for this panel is Dr. Kim Young-hwan, who is a research fellow with the Northeast Asian History Foundation. So we will go in the order of the folks as you see them on the panel. So our first presentation will be by Professor Kang. And you can come up here.
Yeah, I'm going to stand. Well, thank you very much, Victor, and the Northeast Asia History Forum for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here. I did a conference with the Northeast Asia History Forum in Seoul last year, and I found it very illuminating. It's very interesting to bring all these different types of people together, so I think what you do is very useful. And I'm hoping here to be able to provide a little bit of more, I guess, framework or background than I had last year when it was much more specific types of things. So in a way, I apologize if I'm talking too much academic background, but in a way, I hope it'll be interesting. And I only have a couple of PowerPoint presentations. And the way I want to start out is by saying there was a great change in East Asia, as we all know, but we tend to forget about it. And I think these pictures are the most vivid way of presenting this, which is here is famous King Kojong, the last Korean king of the Joseon Dynasty. I'm actually not sure when these pictures were taken, but here he is dressed in his traditional Korean hanbok. Korean pajamas. And then here he is, the same guy, a couple years later. And he looks like Otto von Bismarck with the mustache and the sword and the rack of medals, right? It's the same guy. And just to show it happened to everybody. Here is Taisho Emperor, again dressed in the traditional Japanese pajamas. And then the same guy a couple years later, right? Now, in a way, it almost looks like these guys are a caricature of themselves, trying to dress like Westerners when they're clearly not. But what I'm going to argue is that many, not all, but many of the ways that we think about historical issues today are informed by this great change that took place, which was a transition from a world order, an international system. Roughly, you could call it the Confucian international system, to a Western one. And that Confucian international system had its own internal logic. It had its own norms and institutions and rules. And it was actually quite stable and very long-lasting. Literally, for centuries, countries acted in a certain way. Now, the most interesting thing about the Confucian international system is that it was hegemonic, meaning, as we all know, China was considered the source of civilization. And it was hierarchic. There was a rank order based on how Confucian or how closely you were. So it's no surprise, as we all know, that Japanese, Koreans, and Vietnamese use Chinese characters as a sign of erudition and literature and learning. And they use Chinese literary forms and poetic forms. Political institutions such as the civil exam service. Many of the ideas were taken from China. Even the Japanese, who were not necessarily happy with China being at the center, revered Chinese civilization, even if they looked down on the Chinese government or Chinese people themselves. And with the full arrival of the West in the 19th century, this international order just disappeared. It's gone. And everybody said, this isn't how we do international relations. This is how we do international relations. And overnight, they changed. Now, what's interesting about this transition is that today, nobody questions these rules, the Western rules, the Westphalian rules. And I'm going to come back to this when I talk about in my conclusion, and I'm going to try not to go very long. But this transition has led to a number of very interesting ways in which we now, in the 20th century, or the 21st century, began to view what the countries were and how they related to each other. Because there's a new set of rules, and particularly the Westphalian system is based on ideas of equality. And this is deeply embedded as a normative and institutional aspect of the Western system. Normatively from French Enlightenment thinkers, Rousseau, you know, John Locke in England, the U.S. Constitution, Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. And it's certainly embedded institutionally in the idea that there's one set of countries there's one set of political actors that's allowed to act, and that's nation states, and you either are in the club or you're not in the club. And if you're in the club, everybody's treated the same way. So it's equality as opposed to a rank order or a hierarchy. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that what we end up with then is today every country in the region began to rewrite their history based on these modern rules as opposed to the old Asian rules. Most particularly, and the thing I find most interesting is that many of us today take at face value these histories that were written in the 20th century for a very clear political purpose of elevating countries according to Western ideas and standards. So before, what was considered to be a huge achievement was to be considered high in the rank order, how close you could be towards some Chinese civilizational ideal. And in particular, both Korea and Vietnam were considered in their respective regions the top of the hierarchy because they were very, very similar to Chinese. Almost overnight, this got reinterpreted, where being in a hierarchy was considered to be a sign of weakness, of domination, of submission. And what had to be happened is we had to rewrite history to make it that we were equal to everybody else. Because to admit that you were number two or number five was a sign then that to Western countries that you probably didn't deserve to exist anymore. So Vietnam, and I have more stuff in my paper, but Vietnam, which literally for about 11 centuries was extremely close to China, rewrote their history overnight in the 20th century to emphasize the difference from Vietnam, from China and how many wars they had fought, when the reality is they didn't fight very many wars at all against China. In Korea, the 13 centuries, perhaps, of close emulation and interaction with China, from Silla, Koryo, Joseon Dynasty, immediately we ignore all that. And Shin Chae-ho is probably the best example of this, who reached back 13 centuries to the Goguryeo dynasty, or the kingdom, to say, here's an example of when we were strong and powerful and masculine and everything else. And downplaying 13 centuries of very close emulation with China. Japan, of course, tried to situate itself as the most Western of the Asian countries, and I think we have plenty of other Japan experts here who will be talking about this, but finding a way to situate themselves as not really Chinese, not really in that hierarchy, in a way, always an honorary Western country. So what we today take as face value as these histories, in many ways are a response in the last 100 years to a totally different set of rules and norms and institutions about how countries should interact. And in many ways, it's consequential. And this is just a larger way or a more background way of talking about how we end up with historical disputes in East Asia, because many of them are not actually historical disputes. They're contemporary disputes over whose side of the story gets told, who gets to write the history and emphasize or downplay or ignore certain types of things in the past. And that's always happens. But in East Asia, it's particularly intensified because there's an entire set of rules and norms now that we didn't use more than perhaps 100, 150 years ago. So I'm going to give you an example of that, again, very briefly, when I talk about good fences make good neighbors from the Robert Frost thing. Because the difference, I ask my students this, and I say, what's the difference between a frontier and a border? And in this time, we won't do this here, right? But my quick answer is, a border is a line, and a frontier is a space. And my short one-sentence history of the world is, it's a process of turning frontiers into borders. And interestingly enough, in East Asia, when you had political units who had areas between them that were consequential, they negotiated them into borders that tended to be long-lasting and stable. Phenomenally long-lasting in comparison to Europe. When you had other types of frontiers, particularly maritime frontiers, that back then nobody cared about, they weren't delineated, and they remain a source of problem today. So, for example, Korea's northern border with China basically reached the Yalu by 1034. So literally 1,000 years, that has been the demarcation between Chinese kingdoms and Korean kingdoms. By the time of the Joseon Dynasty, it had actually reached the Yalu and the Tumen Rivers. And this part, Baekdusan, was negotiated in the 17th century. And that border has been stable for literally centuries upon centuries. Interestingly enough, the same thing in Vietnam. Lang Son has been the border between Vietnam and China since 1078 AD, when Song and the Vietnamese dynasties negotiated that this is the border, and there was a great gate at Lang Son, and there was a south-holding frontier post and a ghost gate frontier post. And that's literally the same place where they negotiated the border in 1999. So again, about 1,000 years, that border's been stable. Other areas on the west, which were frontiers, were negotiated over time, and China expanded westward until, and the nomads kept retreating until they ran into the Russians coming south, and the nomads had nowhere left to go. Now, what's interesting about that is I used to live in New Hampshire, and we, the western, the, in many ways, some of the borders are similar to the western demarcations. Because in New Hampshire, if you go, actually this is Vermont, right? But you can go, you drive on a freeway, you get off the freeway, you get on a side road, you go on a dirt road, you, the dirt road ends, you get out of your car, and you hack your way through the jungle, and then in the middle of nowhere is a little white post that says, here's where U.S. stops and Canada begins. Down to the inch, well, you know where it is. I mean, this is a very Western conception. The borders that mattered in East Asia were negotiated that way, but a lot of the other ones weren't. That was a different set of rules. The Western system tends to be more legalized, down to the inch. Here, again, we have Border Patrol, and you can see these little white posts literally in the middle of the forest there somewhere. It's really astonishing how this happened. And we start to get these types of rules in East Asia now for things that historically didn't matter, like a bunch of rocks in the middle of the ocean that nobody cared about before. They didn't think about those things. The only people who cared about them were the fishermen who wanted to avoid them. But nowadays, that matters because we need to get a bunch of frontiers down to borders everywhere. And that has been notoriously difficult to do, particularly because we're using a different set of rules now, and nobody questions this at all. I think that's my last thing. Yeah. So I don't want to spend too much time other than by way of conclusion for this. I think There are clearly many other historical issues that have to do with China-Japan or Korea-Japan relations in the 20th century. But the overall backdrop to this, I think, is a set of countries that had a really long history of interacting with themselves in one way, and then in the last 100, 150 years are learning to interact with each other another way. And so by way of conclusion, let me talk about first China, which I think is perhaps the most interesting, because everybody's worried about the rise of China. There's no way, nobody in China that I know of is planning for a return to the Chinese tributary system. I don't know a single Chinese who thinks that they're going to go back to wearing the Chinese pajamas and the long queue and everything else, right? I mean, Chinese have in many ways accepted the rules and norms of the Western international relations, perhaps more deeply than even Western countries right now. So things like national sovereignty, deciding on borders, and then those borders are fixed, and nobody has the right to change those borders. Chinese have a passport, right? These are all Western ideas that China has clearly accepted 100%. So my sense of how China is going to fit in on these historical things is going to be within the set of rules. It's not a fundamental challenge to the rules of the game. It's where is it going to fit in relation to the other countries within the current set of rules. Now, for other historical issues as well, this is a process of sorting out this transition. And there are many nationalist histories competing with each other in every one of these countries that looks back in time and, frankly, selectively chooses various types of issues, examples, etc., with which to make a case in present. But the problem is actually a political issue today as how countries are going to negotiate their relations with each other. It's actually not history. And somebody pointed out to me once, said, the problem with actually countries having a really long history is that there's examples, whatever you want, you can find an example to prove your case, right? You got 5,000 years or whatever of history, you can find something that'll fit. The U.S. has 200 years of history, and so we don't have quite as many examples. So this is actually much more of a background way of talking about these kind of historical issues. But it might be worth keeping in mind that there is a whole set of ideas, norms, and institutions that we in East Asia have transitioned to, and in many ways is the source of why there's such inability to rewrite the previous history under the different rules, now to rewrite it under the modern rules. This isn't an easy thing to do. So I hope I have been thought-provoking, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Victor. It's a privilege to be here for these discussions, and I'm looking forward very much to everything here, and we are off to a splendid beginning, I would say. My title is Northeast Asia in the context of general global maritime history, and it's a rather broad approach to the subject, but I think perhaps it would be useful to have some background. After all, the sea is the unifier, at least potentially, of the region. It defines it. The ocean really forms the common denominator of Northeast Asia, and it plays the role of avenue, arena, and source. Avenue for the flow of goods and resources, and traditionally, of course, for people and ideas as well, information. And it's an arena for struggle and combat, and now increasingly a source for minerals and foodstuffs, and perhaps much else that lies in the future. Now, a frontier of opportunity, it's also a frontier of challenge. Can we exploit the resources of oceanic space without severely damaging the natural environment or inflaming national passions? So, as a maritime historian, I would like to propose an overview of changing uses of the ocean in Northeast Asia, and I'm focusing on the period from the early 19th century to the present, casting these two centuries in terms of what I call oceanic revolution, a phenomenon that I see is unfolding in three major episodes, two of which happened during this period and one much earlier. Revolution may seem to be an overly used term, but in measure of how the ocean has been used, it seems apt. Without the drama of political revolution, but like the agricultural or industrial revolutions, oceanic revolution has unfolded in a protracted series of spasms of change that have reshaped the world. European initiatives brought about the first burst of oceanic revolution at the turn of the 15th century when intrepid Atlantic navigators discovered the world wind system and used it to open global sea routes. Sea routes for their gunned sailing ships, thus establishing a stream of global interactions. The Atlantic world, unchallenged in its command of blue water space, then began to make its imprint on the societies of Northeast Asia and elsewhere. But Atlantic power at this time was limited to the range of seaborne cannon, and this was conventionally 3 miles and became the generally accepted determinant of national sovereignty over adjoining waters. Other powers rejected Spanish and Portuguese attempts to lay claim to ownership over global oceanic space, following the argument of the Hollander Hugo de Groot, known as Grotius, in proclaiming that the seas were open and common to all. Nonetheless, the North Atlantic powers coursing the world viewed the islands and coastal littorals that they found with a proprietary eye. Sailors and adventurers did not hesitate to attach their own names or identifications, usually English, to places that might have been known for centuries by other names locally. After 1815 and the British defeat of the French in what has been called the Second Hundred Years' War, the Royal Navy of Britain faced no challengers. What then should they do to combat what one captain called the canker of idleness? Arctic exploration offered one such purposeful activity. Chasing slavers and pirates was another. Northeast Asia lay outside the streams of slave traffic, which was largely Africa-centered, but the China coast was rife with piracy and had been for many centuries. Here the British made themselves useful, contributing to the security of seaborne trade flows, in which, of course, they had a very large interest. The Royal Navy busied itself in compiling surveys, sharing its findings with the public, both at home and abroad. Unlike other Europeans, the secretive Spaniards earlier, or the Russians as well. And during the last decades of the 18th century, Captain James Cook, in the spirit of the Enlightenment, set a precedent for publishing voluminous information about his series of remarkable Pacific voyages. And these volumes became bestsellers in the book market at that time. The British enjoyed strategic advantage in transporting troops to the two wars that they fought at mid-century with the Chinese. They could ferry their Indian troops freely up and down the China coast, and that advantage reminds us of the same advantage that the United States Navy had during the Korean War of 1950-1953, command of the sea. In Korean waters, Captain Edmund Pellew of the Royal Navy, in the course of a surveying expedition, sailed in the Komondo Lagoon in 1845 and named it Port Hamilton. The British did not ask for permission to land or for any special privileges there, either from the Koreans, who were then members of the Chinese tributary system, or the Chinese, nominally in charge of Korean foreign affairs. Resting on British maritime power, Britain's maritime law became the default law of the seas, and London arbitration was the accepted means of dispute resolution. The latter half of the 19th century saw a second major spasm of oceanic revolution. Slower to evolve than the first, but equally profound in its impact. The steam engine offered new tactical mobility, making ships independent of wind and current, but carrying strategic liability by making ships newly dependent upon fuel supplies. And so the availability of coaling stations became a hot issue, especially for warships or for those who were planning to use them. Because Britain had an ample supply of coal and an empire with a global sprawl, the new technology of transport gave fresh advantage to the British, and others became newly interested in obtaining coaling stations at strategic intervals on the world's major sea routes. The steam-powered, shallow-draft gunboat, able to penetrate inland freshwater spaces, spread the tentacles of Atlantic presence and power globally, exposing hitherto untouchable territorial spaces to seaborne outsiders, thus establishing new vulnerabilities. China would be a leading example. Foreign warships routinely began to patrol the Yangtze River heartland of Imperial China, extending foreign authority and influence as the Qing state began its collapse into disintegration and demise. At about the same time, the electric undersea cable divorced transportation from communications for the first time in history. By 1871, the cable provided rapid transmission of news linking China to Britain, giving enormous commercial and political advantage to all those who were able to tap this new medium. And a global wired network would follow. Throughout much of the 19th century, Britain, as the world's greatest sea power, could dominate the world ocean and world politics. But as the century waned, the rapidly industrializing United States and Germany, joined by newly internationally active Japan, were beginning to emerge as strategic and commercial rivals, each carrying out territorial empires in East Asia. Japan in Taiwan and Korea, the United States in the Philippines, Germany in Shandong province, all of these made possible by the reach of sea power. But few then recognized that British primacy had reached its peak by 1914, the eve of World War I. Oil had begun to replace coal as the fuel of preference, thus putting Britain, having coal but lacking oil, at great economic and strategic disadvantage. The internal combustion engine brought diesel power to ship propulsion, but the British were slow to adopt it. After two great wars in the latter part of the 20th century, the world moved into a third phase of oceanic revolution. Air power created a competitive new dimension, and in the naval sphere, the gun yielded to the missile, and nuclear propulsion created a new self-sufficiency, providing both tactical and strategic freedom for warships. They could travel wherever, whenever, and however long they wished. And nuclear power made the first true submarines possible, with immense consequences, of course, to transport in the Arctic, for example. For the transport of resources and goods, the bulk carrier and the standard size steel box caused transportation costs to plummet. And this resulted in explosive growth of world trade and world wealth. Americans initiated these changes. The American consumer and the Asian producer reaped the benefits. The core of global maritime activity shifted from the North Atlantic to the China Seas. No place would be affected more by these phenomena than the Republic of Korea. Severed by politics from the Asian landmass, South Korea shed its millennial attachments to the continent and began to take on a new global oceanic life. As in effect, an island, Korea becomes a maritime nation. And now, of course, as you all know, the ROK is a major presence on the world ocean, emerging as the world's leading shipbuilder and one of the world's top 12 economies, enjoying a success undergirded by oceanic trade and the maritime industries. So, thank you very much. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to be back to CSIS, and I'd like to thank CSIS and the Northeast History Foundation for this opportunity to participate in this seminar. I made sure that what I'm going to say is free of any controversy. But anyway, I try to preface my remarks with just the usual caveat that what I'm going to say is purely my own personal perspective on this issue. Since I'm here in CSIS, let me start with a project done by CSIS about 10 years ago. In a book on memory and history in East Asia and Southeast Asia, published by CSIS, year 2000, Gary Gong, who was then senior fellow of CSIS, I guess, argued that the demise of Cold War brought not the end of history, but its resurgence. He predicted that in East Asia, the conflicts about past would shape the future, and that a state was not so much a clash of civilization as a clash of histories, and the battlefield would be the issue of remembering and forgetting. While it is questionable that history has become such a forceful determinant in international relations of East Asia today, as Gary Gong predicted, I think it is true to say that historical issues are now much more salient in both international and national context of East Asia than in the past. While old issues have continued or even exacerbated, new controversies have from time to time broken out to further estrange interstate relations in the region. The salience of historical issues may be attributed to many factors, but one factor which I'd like to address this morning is the human rights laws, international human rights laws and norms, and their influence over historical issues. Let me just briefly explain how international law has evolved with respect to human rights, especially the rise of individual in international law. This phenomenon takes two forms. The first is international protection of individual, and the second, international responsibility of individual. The first phenomenon, this international protection of individual, in the past, how state treats individual, be it its own citizen or foreigner, was largely considered to be domestic affairs of that state. Of course, state's treatment of foreigner often raised sensitive political or legal questions, but generally speaking, the relationship between state and individual was considered to be exclusively domestic affairs of that state. However, this has completely changed through Second World War, and especially this catastrophic experience of Holocaust during Second World War. Now, many people came to realize that the human right is obviously too important to be left with the discretion of state. There should be another layer, probably over state, to protect human rights. So these international human rights norms, international human rights laws has emerged since the end of the Second World War. So human rights is protected, of course, by state, but there is an international level to protect human rights. That is international protection of individual. Now it is no longer considered, the state relationship between state and individual is no longer considered to be a domestic affair of